Hey, and welcome to Foolproof Theology. It's great to be with you here today. Hey, I've got on the show today Bethel McGrew. She is a teacher. She has her PhD in math, or maths, if you're British, and she is an Anglican. Bethel, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chase.
I came across your thinking mainly on Twitter. I was off Twitter for many years, and then I got back on it. And then I was like, well, this person seems intelligent, thoughtful, reflective, and we generally agree on a lot of different stuff. And so I just started tracking you. And there was one topic I wanted to hit on particularly today. And we're going to talk about Revoice, Side B Christianity, and I'll partition that off for the next question. The first question I want to go into, though, is you're a high school teacher, got your PhD in maths. What was it like? Did you have to write a dissertation for your PhD, or what did that involve?
I did. Nobody's going to read it. It was very dry and very technical, and even I was bored with it by the end of it. So, it was a secular institution. Although actually it was a college where my father is the chairman, or has been the chairman, of the philosophy department, Western Michigan University. So it was my alma mater. It's where I did my undergrad in both math and philosophy, actually. So I was really blessed in that I took a lot of my college classes with my dad, which
people
don't get to do generally. Yeah. So then I just kind of made the decision that maybe math would be a good practical avenue to turn to, and they had a very good doctoral program there. Particularly in my subfield, which is graph theory. So that was where I hung out for a few years, did that. But then at the end of it, I felt like my gifts lay more in teaching than in research. So that's where I went next. And so I've been teaching high school for a couple years now.
Okay, that's great. Is Western Michigan Chippewas, or what is their mascot?
Their mascot is the Bronco.
The Bronco, okay. I must be thinking of a different Michigan school. When you did your PhD in maths, and you talked about graph theory, does that involve, when I think of it, I'm just like XY axes? Can you give me a little bit more specificity? I know I'm not a math guy necessarily, but I really am curious because you worked hard on this, and I want to hear a little bit more about it.
Okay, sure. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. So this is confusing because the word graph can refer to different kinds of things. So you're thinking about Cartesian coordinates, plotting points on a plane. So the kind of graph in graph theory is different. It's more like, the way I always explain it is, it's like taking connect the dots and turning it into a whole subdiscipline. So, okay. You throw down some points, and then you start to connect them to each other in different ways, you can count edges, you can color edges, you can color the dots, or give them number labels or whatever, and I mean the whole thing becomes like it's some ways it kind of swings free of other kinds of mathematics, which is neat because you don't necessarily need to be a math guy per se or have tons of math theory in your background to just pick up an intro to graph theory and start playing with it, because in that way it's a little bit more like a game and you're just kind of learning the rules of the game. So you could sort of see how with connecting points to each other, how it might have applications to things like communication networks or whatever.
Yeah.
That wasn't really where my research was. I was always more of the pure math side than the applied math side. But that's what, friends and peers of mine, that's some of the kind of stuff they went on to think about, and applications to social media, things like that.
Sure.
So, in a nutshell,
that's great.
What graph theory is about.
I get to encounter a lot of the people in more of those fields, whether they're scientific or maths, in Boulder. And I have friends from college that went on to do a physics PhD and that kind of thing. And I just always find it fascinating because it's so above my pay grade in terms of area of expertise. And so I appreciate the work you did. I know that's hard work. And what it does, what I love about a good PhD program is it creates in you a disciplined mind, hopefully, a more educated mind, more appreciative of the beauty of God. I am curious to know, There's a theologian that I appreciate a lot named Vern Poitras, and he was big in math, and he's at Westminster Theological Seminary. Have you ever heard of Vern?
I definitely know the name. I haven't dived into his material, but that's cool that there's also a math connection there. And you know, what you just said is so true about the discipline of the mind. And in hindsight, I sometimes wonder, you know, should I have gone into something else? It'd be sort of nice if I had a PhD in X, Y, or Z instead that I was really passionate about. You know, so what did I really get out of the math PhD? And I mean, well, there's a couple things. For one thing, it's more likely that I'll get paid what I'm worth at a given school. Yeah, I've started to discover that as I go job hunting now. But also, yeah, it instilled discipline in me, and just the work that I had to do to pass my preliminary exams. You know, just like the day in, day out, okay, I need to take this fat book full of real analysis or abstract algebra or something and work every problem and go to the library every day and memorize all this stuff. Those are habits of mind that you can then take with you in life generally.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about Revoice. And the way I want to get into that is by kind of sharing my kind of understanding, and I want you to help my listeners understand. So I didn't even know what Revoice was. I had heard about Side B, all this kind of stuff. In fact, before 2020, when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to study my PhD, it was actually an area of interest of mine because it deals with desire, motivations, sinful tendencies, all this kind of stuff. And in THM in my book deals with spiritual formation, Christian spirituality, Christian disciplines, and it deals with the kind of subjective nature of our motives. And so I was thinking about, man, like, what would it be like to examine Side B or something like that in terms of, like, when does a motive become a sin, all these kind of things. I ended up going a different direction, still within a general discipline, but the whole Revoice thing seemed to come out, it feels like it came out of nowhere. It feels like a lot of people don't know what it is. But when I read some of the stuff you've written, when I look into it, I'm like, these have some big names in it. So can you help kind of my listeners understand what is Revoice? Where is it centrally located and what's going on with it?
Sure. So Revoice is the name of a conference, began in 2018 and is still going. As far as where it's centrally located, they've met in a few different places. So initially they met in Missouri in a church that's actually kind of been a flashpoint of some controversy in the PCA because they left the PCA recently. They're now, last couple of years, I think they've met the same church in Texas. So in terms of where, I wasn't sure what you meant by where.
Sure, no, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, and then denominationally, they're really kind of all over the place. It's sort of a melting pot of Protestant, mostly Protestant, I would say, but there's a few Catholics in the mix too. So the conference began in 2018, and what it was is it was a place for same-sex attracted Christians to come together and you know, have a space, as they put it, to give lectures and mingle and fellowship and talk about strategies for how to integrate same-sex attracted people into the church. And it may seem like it came out of nowhere, but it didn't in terms of the time it took to sort of lay the groundwork for it.
Okay.
So Wesley Hill is one important name in all of this. And I think one landmark event that I point to is that he published his memoir, Washed and Waiting, in the year 2010. And that book really made waves because it represented the beginning of a sort of a paradigm shift, maybe, in how the church thought about this issue, because, you know, you really had these two poles. You had either full-on affirmation, mainline,
right,
rainbow flag on the altar, that kind of thing,
yeah.
Or you had your Exodus model, your ex-gay therapy model, where a lot of times kids would be sent to a conference by one of these ministries, and there'd be often an attempt to see if you could cure the inclination and steer people into straight marriages and things like that.
Right.
That hit some icebergs. you know, there were frustrations and inadequacies and holes in that model. There was also corruption in the leadership, which demoralized things. And so when Wes Hill came on the scene, people were kind of inspired and encouraged, thinking, oh, it, well, maybe this could be the beginning of a better way, a third way, if you will, sure. Where we, you know, we don't make promises. We don't sort of hitch this to a prosperity gospel type model of things. But we're still chaste. We're still committed to the traditional sexual ethic. And, you know, maybe we could handle this with more maturity and sensitivity and chart a different course. So Wes, together with a Catholic friend, Ron Belgau, founded a blog called Spiritual Friendship. And so together with other friends and colleagues, they started to develop their theology of all of this. Hmm. And a main sort of building block of their theology was that homosexuality is more a distortion of the friendship impulse than the romantic impulse. So they wanted to explore ways that same-sex attraction could be sort of maybe redeemed in some ways, that like maybe it wasn't necessarily all bad. Maybe it could be channeled into a recovery of friendship, right? And so they spent years laying this out. And over that time, concerns arose and they met some criticism and there was lots of give and take. And so their work then sort of culminated in 2018 with the first Revoice conference. And over the few years since then, there've just been more and more red flags coming up until this year, this past year when World Magazine did a report. And I think that was when a lot of people sort of in the mainstream first learned about this, learned what this was, learned what some of the issues were, that some of us who had been following it for years were like, yeah, but we kind of saw this coming. Yeah, this sure, is, yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time coming.
Was this something that you were just kind of like, this is really interesting to me, I'm going to keep in touch with it? Were you connected with some of the people in leadership, or what kind of got your interest in this topic?
So, I mean, I was young. I was just starting to kind of become really socially, politically, culturally aware when the Spiritual Friendship blog got going. And it was something that my mother wrote about some, because she has her finger in a lot of pies, but she was sort of she would have had a Substack back in the day if there was Substack.
Sure.
And so she, you know, she really kept her finger on the pulse of these kinds of things. And so then through her, as I kind of read her writing and reactions to it, that was forming and shaping my understanding. And so, yeah, the more reading I did, the more I thought, oh, wow, this is something I need to keep tabs on. This could really be a problem going forward. So then, yeah, I just have kind of naturally kept up with it. And I have come to, you know, to make friends who either experienced SSA or actually were in the lifestyle that came out of it. Right. In general, I have a little bit of a research focus there, and it's something that I think about. It's something I kind of have a heart for, because I really want to think about ways to help people practically there.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, as we see kind of the rise of the next generation, that's really experienced a really prolific movement towards all these LGBTQ, particularly with the trans and the youth. This topic will be very important for Christian thinkers, Christian leaders, and pastors to think carefully about. And so, like, one topic you brought up with kind of the inception point, with the idea that there's something redeemable, right, in the SSA kind of like spiritual friendship attitude. I've even seen this in one friend that I have that's SSA, ended up marrying a person of the same sex. And the whole time, all of us that know her, we're thinking, you just like being really close to her and being a good friend. Like, she's just a friend. You don't have to like take it to the next level. And so I feel like there seems to be some truth to that. But is there something I'm missing there that's a seed of something bad?
These things are really complicated. What you seem to be going, probably they they might not like the direction you're going with that, because it seems like underneath that, what you're saying is you're not really a lesbian.
I guess that's true.
a lot of gay men might agree with you there, but anyway, seriously, that's like, it's almost like a joke with gay men that there is no such thing as a lesbian.
That's funny.
Right. Yeah. These things are very tricky. And, the issue with what Spiritual Friendship was doing is they were trying to do, I mean, it was a resourcement project. I mean, resourcement is kind of a big deal then. So their resourcement project was digging up all kinds of old writing and stuff around friendship, and trying to recover it and like save friendship from the sexual revolution. But the issue was that they still wanted to frame it in a way that somehow incorporated same-sex attraction. And like these are things that are, there's a tension there that they either, couldn't see or didn't want to see. Hmm. Which is that these things are going to bleed together, and there is going to be a heightened quality. There is going to be something that's more than friendship that means that extra care has to be, taken at some parallels are going to break down, right? That you can't just necessarily take, for example, the model of David and Jonathan in the Old Testament or Ruth and Naomi and do like a copy paste,
right.
You know, because there are inherent differences in the situations.
Yeah. So they kind of suggest there's a side B, from what I understand, where we're not open and affirming, like, you know, crazy Methodist, whatever it is, you know, with the rainbow flag and all that, or a lot of churches in Boulder. But we are celibate, but open about our SSA inclinations.
Yeah.
Is that how they would articulate it?
Right. We're open about it. And we, you know, we might describe ourselves as gay. And we also don't necessarily think that all elements of gay identity are wrong or bad. So, so Hill wrote a blog post where he talked about how being gay kind of suffused all of who he was.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And they'll say, well, there could be such a thing as same-sex intimacy or same-sex romance. That's, you know, but like it falls short of sexual acts, but that there could still be room to work there. And I mean, so there's a younger guy, Grant Hartley. He wasn't one of the founding voices, but he was at the first Revoice conference, and he's been one of those figures who sort of says the quiet part out loud in a way.
Right.
And so he's interesting to follow, I think, for people. And so there was a thread he made not too long ago where he was like, side B was never about eliminating all same-sex romance, just same-sex sex. So that's where you red flags tend to start popping up. And also, too, you could see right from the first Revoice conference with Nate Collins, who was another founding guy, baked into the cake was a lot of intense resentment against the church and a strong sense of being an identity group. You know, like we as a collective have been hurt and victimized by church culture that refuses to understand us. So what we have to do is, I mean, the name Revoice means we have to teach the church to sing in a different key, right? We have to change church attitudes to us. And we have to insert ourselves into like all levels of church leadership, right? So we need to like eliminate any at all double standards that might exist in hiring or ministry opportunities or that kind of thing. Those should not exist. Those are fundamentally unjust. And we need to sort of re-educate Christians, basically, to use certain code words, avoid certain kinds of language, and sort of like be um, to basically listen to us, right? I mean, we have to kind of take the microphone and give the church a new instruction manual, basically.
So these people are, I mean, what you're describing sounds like revolutionaries.
Yeah, that's how they saw themselves. I mean, the way Nate Collins will talk, he'll say, you know, he used the word prophets. Like, you know, we are prophets, and our message is that the church has come to idolize heterosexual marriage, has come to idolize the nuclear family, and because we don't fit neatly into those categories, we have this prophetic role to play, to call out these idolatries in the church.
Wow. Interesting. That's very fascinating. What one person I'm curious to know if he's connected with Revoice, because I was doing some research last night in preparation for our conversation today, and I found a lot of people that I know personally. I was like, oh no, like I know a lot of people connected with this. But there was one guy that he came to Denver Seminary, that which is my alma mater, and they keep, they're very third way. That's like their shtick, man. But they brought in this guy named Preston Sprinkle, and I've been very perplexed by Preston. So can you help me understand? Yeah, I'd love to hear some of those so that you,
because
my friends are very convinced by him, you know, and he comes across as a very likable person. And so I just don't, I have a hard time understanding what's his take on Revoice. Is he in leadership there? What is he like?
Yeah, he's not in leadership, but he's sort of a self-styled ally. You know, he's like the Christian version of the ally guy. Okay. So he was there from the beginning, and he's spoken there since then, and he's written a couple of books. Yeah, Preston is an interesting character. I'll try to say something nice about him to start. One genuine nice thing I can say about him is that I think some of his podcast stuff has been useful in the area of trans, because he is able to go out there and get conversations with interesting people in that space, including detrans people. Yeah. So I do want to give him credit there that he's given quite a few detransitioners a platform to tell their stories on his podcast, and you know, to speak frankly about some of the dangers of gender transition. Okay, so now to say some not so nice things about Preston. I think his understanding of all of this is still pretty shallow, and the general tack that he's taken when he speaks at these conferences is just churches have not been loving enough. You know, we need to be just like really, really sensitive and open and willing to take criticism. And I don't know, how could anyone possibly have a problem with a conference like this? How could anyone, you know, if you have issues with this, then you know, probably that's a problem with you, not with us. You know, the way he put it, I wrote, I kind of touched on his 2021 session in an article I wrote for Icon, which we can put in the show notes. But he had this one phrase that just had me facepalming. It was like, the knee-jerk reaction should be love. The knee-jerk response should be compassion. I know. And he used the phrase knee-jerk unironically, you know, like as if this would be a good thing, which unfortunately I think sort of sums up Preston Sprinkle, because, and I mean, it's not that I don't think he's a bright guy, but I mean, like I said, he sees himself as an ally, and so yeah, in that capacity, I don't think that he is sufficiently engaged with good faith criticism of the Psy-B Revoice movement, or you know, he might be open to some, like you know, he'll host like Rachel Gilson and Greg Coles might have a conversation, but Gilson herself is kind of third way-ish, and she'll still approach it like, yeah, I have disagreements with my brother Greg, but in the end I know we're both in good faith and we're both sincere Christians pursuing our, instead of just saying that Greg Coles is a wolf, which I think he is.
Wow.
So, you know, so yeah, that's the issue. Like the minute that you say something stronger like that, like, okay, yeah, we just need to shut this whole thing down. Like this thing is not salvageable. There's too, you know, just no, then it's like, what kind of a bigoted person are you? So yeah, anyway, sure. I'm getting sidetracked. But yeah, I have issues with Preston. Oh, and another thing, and this is more sort of connected to who Preston works with, who he boosts, who he considers a close friend and colleague here, but he will heavily promote the work of an organization called Posture Shift, okay. Which is headed up by a guy named Bill Henson. And they've developed this curriculum called Guiding Families of LGBT Kids. And that's been integrated to Revoice from the beginning. He speaks at almost all of their conferences. They sell the curriculum there. So they're very much like a sister ministry. And that curriculum has a lot of problems. I bought it. I own it. It's on my shelf. At one point on my old Twitter account, I had a little thread sort of highlighting some issues. And I mean, essentially what it is it's like gaslighting. You know, it's telling parents all the things they can and can't say, all the ways their posture needs to shift, you know, according to the name of the org. And so, yeah, just again, lots of red flags. And that guy, Bill Henson, who heads that ministry, will even say that parents should make concessions as far as preferred pronouns and things like that. And so that, I mean, like, Preston promotes him every other chance he gets. And there's one figure in particular who's good friends with Preston. She's the director of donor relations at Posture Shift. And she refers to herself by they, them pronouns. Yeah. And I mean, she has a lot of pain and trauma in her backstory, sure. Which, but the problem is that she's in a position of a lot of leadership and influence now. And you know, is guiding young people and speaking authoritatively, right? And so Preston is friends with her. It goes around sharing her testimony everywhere and saying she's so great, you know. And the problem is that that Preston is not distinguishing between this is a person that we can have compassion for, this is a person we could befriend, be sensitive to, etc., and this is a person who should be in leadership, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's a distinction he refuses to make. So I could go on. His books are anyway. Like little nutshell thing.
No, that's great. Thanks for helping me understand better kind of the landscape there. I think when I had met with the president of Denver Seminary on multiple occasions over the last couple of years, trying to help him understand why the institution's being perceived as left, and they keep saying they're middle, and he's like, we're trying to, you know, be biblical. And I'm like, yeah, but you're only talking about cultural matters that matter to the left by attacking the right. And I was like, what we need is more debate in academic institutions that are Christian. We need more robust dialogue. And so I was hopeful when they started a new series on debate and this kind of thing. I was like, oh, who are they going to have? Are they going to have Nancy Pierce? Are they going to have somebody, you know, more solid? And the representing the right was Preston Sprinkle, right? Representing the most conservative position. And I was like, no.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, I mean, I think Preston sort of, because he wrote this book on hell with Francis Chan, where he took the conservative position on hell. And so that's sort of like built up some conservative cred for himself. And so I've seen how this works in multiple situations. You know, once people have some accumulated social capital, yeah. It becomes difficult for the people around them to sort of recognize drift and be like, hey, that's not so good, right?
Right.
Instead, it just becomes like a mutual endorsement system.
Oh my gosh.
You know?
Yeah, that whole machine, it kind of grosses me out. It's like, it's just an industrial complex of just people just kind of endorsing each other's work blindly. And you know, there's something to be said for loyalty. I think Aaron Wren offers a lot of good thoughts on like the value of loyalty and friendship, but at the same time, there's so much just kind of blindness to like, what are we endorsing? What are we saying? Why are you doing it? Are you just doing it because like you texted each other and like your big college buddies, you know?
Then it becomes a kind of a chain reaction as it trickles down. So like, oh, well, if so-and-so, I mean, so I'll take Greg Johnson as another important name I'll bring in here. He was the pastor of Memorial Presbyterian, which was the first church to host the Revoice Conference. So for anybody who follows Inside PCA baseball, his name is familiar because he came out as openly gay in 2019. And since then, he's been sort of a focal point for controversy in the PCA. So he and Memorial recently voted to just leave the denomination. And so he, lots of red flags with him. His material is not good. I've read his book a couple different times now, and I keep starting to review it and getting discouraged and stopping, but I'll do it at some point. So there's Johnson, but then you have somebody like, for example, Sam Alberry, who's English and is regarded as like to the right of Revoice. I mean, he's never been directly affiliated with Side B Revoice.
Right.
People think of him as more conservative, maybe more in Rachel Gilson's zone. But Sam Alberry will say nice things about Greg Johnson's work. So
right.
As it trickles down, people are like, oh, well, I like Sam Alberry. And so if he thinks this is good, then maybe it's not so bad, right? And then so it trickles down.
It's crazy. Who was there was one Christian, she wrote for Crossway. She did a debate on TGC,
Rebecca McLaughlin. I know her. Yep.
Yeah. Is she within this conversation as well or no?
She is herself same-sex attracted, although she's married to a guy and has children. I would kind of bin her with Rachel Gilson, although Rachel has had more conversations and talked more in this sphere. Rebecca's never written a book about her same-sex attraction or had podcasts or debates about it. It's just something that she's mentioned in the course of her other work. I think she's tended to play a little closer to the vest. Probably she would be also more conservative than Side B Revoice, but maybe also like Gilson, too willing to try and build bridges or have conversations and not just like come right out and mark and avoid and denounce. And say, okay, this project needs to be scrapped. Those people over there are all wolves. You know, like she's not going to do that.
Yeah. Either. Yeah. Two more names, and then I want to go back into Revoice and its development and where it's at today. So there's Rosaria Butterfield. I think that's her name.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think she was on a podcast in the last year. I think it was the OPC podcast or something like that. And it seemed like she had shifted if we want to use a spectrum, far to the right in terms of her critique, like never identify yourself as gay. Now, don't even say it.
Yes.
You know, you should smash those desires. And I was listening to it in my kitchen. I was like, good Lord. Like this, who is this?
she is a great, and she's actually become a personal friend. So I love Rosaria. What's interesting about Rosaria is that when she first came on the scene, I mean, there was a period where she was sort of the it girl, like the TGC it girl.
Yep.
And there were things that she said in that phase that in hindsight sound a little bit squishy, and she will even agree with you that they sound a little bit squishy in hindsight.
Okay.
So, you know, she would talk in missional ways about, like, you know, getting to know your gay neighbors.
Yes.
Trying to be sensitive, and, you know, here's what you can still find on TGC. There's a little short Q&A, like, what do Christians just not get about LGBT folks? And she gives her answer. So, it's interesting. And she would also, at that time, talk about pronoun hospitality. So a bit of a J.D. Greer thing.
Yep.
What's cool is that in more recent years, she has like straight up retracted certain things that she said, especially the pronoun hospitality thing. Like she, you know, she's working on a new manuscript where she's like, I said that, it was wrong, I repent, I retract, you know?
Yeah.
So she is like shifted even further, right? She was always pretty conservative, but now she's like even further. And as Side B and Revoice has developed, figures like her and Christopher Yuan, who was sort of in her zone, have strongly planted their flag against all of that. And so, okay. I mean, she will just come out and denounce. Like she is just going to say all of that stuff out loud. I love her. I don't know that she and I have exactly the same theological framework for thinking about all of these things.
Okay. But, tell me more about that.
Oh, well, I mean, it gets a little bit fiddly or complicated, but, but anyway, that's who Rosaria is. So I didn't know if you wanted to say more.
No, I really do. I really am curious. What would be the theological difference or in the approach that you and Rosaria might take on this matter.
Yeah, well, so she's very reformed, and I'm not reformed.
Okay.
So, I mean, that could get into a sort of a more, yeah, a more nerdy kind of theological thing here. But one thing I notice, and I see this today in some of the, like Jared Moore, who talks and writes quite a bit about this, or the way that Al Mohr used to talk about this, is they tried to say, well, the fundamental issue with the theology underneath Spiritual Friendship and Revoice is that it has a Catholic understanding of same-sex attraction, right? And so what's needed is a Protestant Reformed understanding of concupiscence, right? And so then that's going to be like the Achilles heel there. The problem is, though, how do I put this? I think you could be Catholic and strongly against the whole Side B Revoice shtick. I don't think it's necessary to take on a Reformed frame for concupiscence in order to oppose them theologically.
Okay, hold on right there, because I want you to unpack that to help me understand. So you've got people saying that, like, I'm going to put it in like bro terms.
Sure. I can break it down. Let me know if
so. Catholic leads to gay. Like, Catholic's gay, and like Protestant Reform is not. And so, well, like, it's inherent in the theological framework of Catholicism with concupiscence that that gayness is totally fine.
Well, yeah. Let me nuance that more. So
yeah, go.
The problem I think that people would say is that within the Catholic understanding, it's not necessarily that Catholic inevitably leads to gay, but it's that same-sex attraction in and of itself is not a sin in the Catholic frame.
Really?
Yeah. Whereas it is a sin, you know, like even the desire, yeah, concupiscence is a big word. But like, yeah, even the...
Explain what that word is, just so that we're on the same page.
Sure. So concupiscence, basically it means lust, right? Or a strong sexual desire. So, I mean, everyone agrees that active lust is a sin in the sense of allowing yourself to fantasize and that sort of thing. But in a Reformed framework, it's an even stronger idea that, you know, that for the desire even to exist in you is sinful. And that's not where the Catholic understanding is. The Catholics would use the word disordered. So if you have same-sex attraction, that's a disordered desire because it's not oriented towards the other. It's oriented in the wrong direction.
Okay.
But it you know, may not be in and of itself a sin. It's just something that you need to resist. And then it could manifest in sin, of course.
Fascinating.
So basically, there was an idea that... That we need to fight Side B and Revoice by underscoring the idea that same-sex desire is inherently sinful.
Right.
Whereas I always took, because I was always in more of an Anglo-Catholic frame, I could look at things that, because there were some, the Catholics involved in Revoice Side B, they had tension with elements of their own Catholic tradition. So, for example, they would write essays all about how they didn't like the phrase disordered. You know, they're like, this annoys me. Eve Tushnet is a Catholic, big Catholic name out here. They didn't like the fact that conservative Catholics would say same-sex attraction was disordered. So my thinking was, even just holding the line there is, I think, enough. I think that's enough to push back on Side B Revoice, because they're not even going to concede that. So I think sometimes people can get distracted by, like, you know, like Jared Moore dislikes some things that Kevin DeYoung wrote because he felt like Kevin wasn't strong enough on emphasizing that same-sex desire is in and of itself sinful. Okay. Whereas I look at it and I think that was great overall. I don't,
sure.
You know, I think you can tend to kind of nitpick there.
Right.
You have like bigger take a bigger picture view here, you know.
Yeah. So from your perspective, though, because this kind of gets into something I wanted to figure out, and I'm wrestling through, I'm trying to understand biblically, theologically, when we think about desires that are disordered, to use that terminology, and to think as a Protestant, how the Protestant Reformed tradition is trying to drill down further and say even those desires are sinful. That's something that's intuitive in me where I go, yeah, that makes sense. Like if I desire sin, then that desire itself is sin. So is that something that you would say is an incorrect assumption or conclusion?
Yeah. I mean, this is really interesting, and I know exactly what you mean. This of course gets into questions like, you know, what does it mean when we say that Jesus experienced temptation without sin?
Right.
Right. You know, could Jesus desire something, but in a way that wasn't sinful? And like, what does that even mean? And what does that mean for us? Right. These things get very fine grained very quickly.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, like the way I would put it is I tend to, and again, this may be my Arminian coming out. I tend to think of these things in terms of willed versus unwilled, right? So, you know, if a guy sees another guy walking down the street and just has this sort of like automatic, no, that guy's attractive. It's like the thought sort of bubbles up in his mind before he's even had a chance to verbally articulate it, you know? And then he immediately thinks, it's happening again. I gotta go to the gym or something, you know,
sure.
and try to get that thought out of my head. Was that moment a sin, right?
Right.
Or was it like a potential gateway to sin, which then if you're trying to mortify the flesh and all that good stuff, you can then distract yourself and move on from it, right?
Right.
I would argue that moment was not necessarily a moment of sin, but it could have led to sin if he didn't nip it in the bud.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I think I would argue that just thinking pastorally, like, because when I deal with this with individuals that go to my church, I would still argue that the thought itself is a sinful thought. If that attraction is something more than just appreciating the beauty of another human or being like, that guy's super fit, you know, or something like that. But like,
which hetero guys can do too, but there's no sexual element to it. Right. Yeah, exactly.
So like, but you're going to have to get into kind of like pastoral counsel and biblical counsel and being led by the Spirit, where it's like, still that thought itself, if I have a wicked thought, use a different sin about murder or jealousy, covetousness, that thought itself, while I agree with you, it's a temptation. What you're saying is that based on your perspective, you would say Jesus could have had those thoughts, but he never acted on them. And what I'm saying is that he never even had those thoughts.
So, okay. Now you raise a really interesting point here because, I'm still thinking about this myself, but I think there might be a kind of, like a sort of a separate category for thoughts that we might have because we have a sin nature,
right?
Which Jesus did not have,
right?
Right. So, like, there are things that might enter our minds as a consequence of sin nature that would never even have entered Jesus' mind, but I'm not sure that I would say that they constitute sins because I still tend to classify sin as an act of the will.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense.
So, you know, I'm not a theologian. Many, many books and papers have been written in this area, but that's my very rough kind of layman's way of starting to parse this stuff.
You know? No, but I think that gives people a kind of window into some of how these issues get really complicated, how these issues, and a lot of Christians don't get to have these kind of conversations. It's something I'm very interested in my research in terms of soul care, spiritual care, pastoral counsel. And so thanks for kind of chopping it up with me on that topic. Going back to Revoice, where is it today? You know, you've got in 2018, it, you know, you had a lot of like, was, I can't figure out, was Carson, D.A. Carson and Tim Keller, were they like kind of like giving the thumbs up to Revoice or no?
Good question. So unfortunately, D.A. Carson did endorse a book by a Revoice guy. It was Greg Cole's memoir.
Gay Single Christian or something?
Yeah, Single Gay Christian. That was it. Okay. And unfortunately, Carson did not really understand what all was at stake here and just sort of read it and thought, oh, what a nice, sensitive young guy who's wrestling with his same-sex attraction. I'm going to help him out as the, you know, the established old gray head here helping out the young guy. So that was a problem, and that's also something that can happen. Keller, Keller will, for example, I saw him endorsing Greg Johnson's book recently. Keller has tried to be careful, and sort of, you know, in his usual way, tried to sort of navigate a third way path. The problem I see, this is sort of getting into the weeds a little bit maybe, but because Keller is a big name, it might be sort of important to give a sense of where he is here. The issue that I see with Keller is that he could tend to take a, you know, yeah, there might be an issue, but it's a really, really minor issue. We don't need to be worried about it on a grand scale. Again, people who are like really actively in the PCA, who've seen behind the curtain, who know the kind of backstage conversations that are happening, know that's not true. They know that's not true. Johnson has a lot of people in his corner. And even now that he's left the PCA, I'm sure there's a lot of people still in the PCA who think it's terribly unfair that he was driven out, you know? So,
yeah, driven out.
So and yeah,
it,
that
I have a lot of personal dislike when I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think it's Memorial PCA or was PCA, Memorial Presbyterian, Greg Johnson, is that correct?
Yeah.
Was that the church that was allowing some kind of drag or gay club and he was serving as a bartender? Is that right?
I don't remember.
Serving drinks or something.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I don't remember that particular bit of it. But yes, they had this this ongoing ministry. And that, I mean, I still want to write a piece about Kellerism and Center Church and missional stuff where I kind of use that as a test case for how all of that can go very wrong. Basically, I mean, it began as like this local ministry, which began with good intentions and was a sort of a community outreach project. It slid into very murky places when it began intersecting with the gay performing arts community, who began using the church space as a venue to put on plays and shows and performances that were just openly degenerate. So eventually, even the more moderate types had a problem with it and approached Johnson, other people involved with it, saying, we feel like this is an issue. You shouldn't use the church space for this kind of thing. And they couldn't come to an agreement. And so that was a big factor in the split eventually.
Yeah, that makes sense. So with kind of all this stuff going on, you know, they've got a 2021 conference, or they did. Is there another one coming? And do you anticipate more kind of trans stuff coming out with it?
Well, it's 2023, Chase, now. They had a – oh, God, I put the wrong date down. So 2022 was the very most recent one. So that was the one where World Magazine did their comprehensive report. And then before that, I had written about the 2021, where I think you already even saw some of the things there that were also present at the 2022 conference. So, a lot of problematic red flags. So just to kind of run through a few of them quickly. So I mentioned before this woman who directs donor relations at their sister ministry, Posture Shift. She was already speaking and you know, but identifying as they, them in 2021, continued to do that in 2022. And she significantly, when she gave her talk, she wore a t-shirt that had the trans flag on it. But over top of it, it had the words Imago Dei. And so I think, you know, it's a subtle thing, but I think symbolically it has a lot of meaning, because what it signals is a co-identification of sexual identity with human dignity. So that if you were to deny her her preferred pronouns or sexual identity, it would be like an assault on her dignity as a person. And then also there was an encouraging of people in the audience to write their preferred pronouns on their name tags, right?
Wow.
Yeah. It's so that the trans issue is making itself felt there. And also people were being told that they should like repot and replant, like they should change churches if the pastoral staff isn't willing to make certain language accommodations. So yeah, like if the church is not willing to like use preferred pronouns or you know, recognize your identity or whatever, well, I guess it's time to find a new church, basically. So, and I mean, and yet they were all still saying, oh, but we don't affirm sexual acts. Like, we're still trying to encourage people to be chaste and stuff. At a certain point, though, you have to ask how far up to the line are you trying to go? You know, It's like almost, it's like they're trying to take on board almost everything short of saying that gay sex is fine.
Right.
You know,
that's crazy. They're training up revolutionaries, and it's the same pressure that pastors were put under in 2020 with the BLM stuff, because pastors were being called to account. And if you as a pastor in our church won't issue a statement, you know, of our guilt, you know, then I'm going to leave. And it's like, what? No, you don't have to leave. Like, we can talk. Like, we can look at the Bible. Yeah. We can look at the scriptures together. And like, these revolutionary ideas, they just keep coming at churches.
And there is a lot of that intersectionality at work there. In 2021, they had a panel of like just the minorities who were there. And so they did the whole, well, speaking as a Black man who is also gay, sure, right? Yeah. So, you know, a lot of that theology is coming down where it's, you know, the matrix of oppression or whatever. In that sense, there is a very pernicious idea of identifying themselves with the civil rights struggles of racial minorities, right? So they're very much calling back to that language and that vibe. The way, so I mentioned Grant Hartley, who's this younger voice who sort of will say things out loud. He's given a couple of different workshops, or the same workshop a couple of times, about queer treasure, which raised a lot of red flags and a lot of discussion, where he was like, well, how could we mine LGBT culture for treasure that might still be brought into the kingdom? And how can we like think missionally here? And I'm going to kind of like borrow some stuff from Tim Keller, but apply it to LGBT stuff. Right. So he did it within this very left-wing framework. And he presented this whole kind of potted history of LGBT issues and activism and things like that, where, you know, like looking at guys like Harvey Milk through rose-colored glasses, you know, like literally rose-colored pink glasses, you know, and so there's still like a sense of solidarity with secular LGBT people. Like, well, even if they think gay sex is okay and we don't, we still have a sense of shared identity with them. So then, you know, the question is, okay, with whom do you have more of a sense of shared identity? Is it with LGBT as a group, or is it with your fellow believers as a group?
Right. Yeah.
That's the question that has to be answered at the end of the
day. That is the question. And I don't know that they're ready to answer it, because it would be very revealing. So I think that's a great way to kind of conclude. This has been really helpful. It's helped me kind of navigate, okay, this is what's going on. And it's helped me kind of like, you know, process particular issues that I'm really curious about. So thanks so much for spending time with me today to kind of give me some better insight on this topic.
Thank you.
I
only wish we could talk longer, but yeah, I'm glad this has been helpful.
Yeah. The thing I want to make sure we do is promote any content you want to promote. And so I'll put a hyperlink to your Twitter account. Where else can people find your writing and thinking?
Sure. So where I mostly do my writing now is at my Substack, which it's really easy. It's just BethelMcGrew.substack.com.
There you go.
But I call it Further Up to sort of evoke C.S. Lewis a little bit. And actually just just this week I hit a milestone. I hit 10,000 annualized in subscriptions there. So
wow, that's really impressive. Congrats.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Thank you. Yeah, and it hasn't even been 2 years that I've been writing it, so that's very cool.
Dude, very cool.
Yeah. So that's mostly where I write my stuff, and I don't necessarily do a lot of church writing there, or like evangelical politics, that kind of thing. I do more of that at my Pathos blog, which I don't keep up like I used to, but I still do have a Pathos spot called Young Fogey. So like if I were to do more writing on guys like Preston Sprinkle or Greg Johnson, that's where I would sort of put that, assuming that they still let me keep the space there.
Sure.
So yeah, those are my two platforms. And then yeah, people can find me on Twitter. And so that's where you can keep up with updates for freelance work. I'm working on something about all of this for First Things, which has now been pushed down because Benedict died and stuff. Mm. But I'm excited about that piece, and I hope that'll generate some good conversation once it's out. So then Twitter is where you would see that was finally out.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chase. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, if you're a listener and you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you share this content with others. I think it's a great conversation starter, gets people thinking more deeply. So share it with somebody else, give it a great rating, subscribe so you can stay up to date with the next episode coming out. We have some great guests coming up. Also, I'm going to put a link to the Patreon in the show notes, so if you can sign up there, any dollar amount helps me bring great content to you like this. And so I'd love it if you go there, sign up, be part of the conversation, help me produce better content. You can share your ideas, feedback, and we can have conversations on Patreon. So go there, sign up, and we will see you next time.